It is good to be together 4 days before Thanksgiving. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It's a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Children would like to come up on the stage over there. Originally, Kathy and I were—I was going to tell you the Thanksgiving story. Then Kathy and I were going to sing a song, but my voice went away, and so three of our brilliant, talented, and available musicians learned the song at 9 o'clock this morning to sing it. But I'll still tell you the Thanksgiving story. 82 years ago, in 1620. Was when the Pilgrims first came to this country. And it's a story we should know about, even though it has a lot of sad parts to it. They had started out in England, and they left England because they didn't have religious freedom. They couldn't believe what they wanted to believe. From England, they went to Holland. And you've heard the story of the three bears, where Goldilocks would try the porridge, and some was too hot, and some was too cold. Well, that's what the Pilgrims found in England. It was too cold, and they couldn't believe what they wanted to believe. And in Holland, it was too hot, because they could believe anything they wanted, and so could everybody else. And these Pilgrims really didn't want freedom for everybody to believe what they wanted. They just wanted freedom for everyone to believe what they believed. It's true. So they left Holland to come here to build a country where everyone could believe only what they believed. There were 102 of them, and when they left in two boats, but one of the boats wasn't good, and they had to go back and all get in just one boat, the Mayflower. So 102 came over, and they arrived about this time of year, and they got here during one of the record horrible winters in Massachusetts. It was terribly cold and terribly snowy. They lived in some wigwams that had been abandoned by some Indians there. And some Indians had showed them how to use the wigwams and get in them. And they lived there for the winter. Nevertheless, it was a very hard winter. And out of 102 of them, 47 of them died that winter. Almost half of them. Now that's amazing and very sad. In the spring, they planted crops, and they'd been burying their friends and family all year long. They were lucky to have an Indian friend named Squanto, who actually spoke English. He had gone to England 15 years earlier, in 1605, and he'd learned English and happened to come back not too long after they'd arrived. And so they were lucky to be in the area with the Indian who knew English better than any Indian in America. They might not have made it at all. Squanto helped them plant crops and helped them figure out how to grow the foods that were here in the New World. And their harvest was very good. And so that fall at harvest time, they had a harvest festival. In England, they'd call these the Harvest Home Festival. Here we've called it Thanksgiving. And they invited the Indians. And the menu for that first Thanksgiving was pretty amazing. And I want to read you the menu for the first Thanksgiving. Now, don't drool. They had venison stew cooked over an outdoor fire, spit-roasted wild turkeys stuffed with cornbread, oysters baked in their shells, sweet corn baked in its husks, and pumpkin baked in a bag and flavored with maple syrup. The food was served on large wooden platters, and everyone ate their fill, and they ate for 3 days at the first Thanksgiving. After dinner, according to legend, Chief Massasoit's brother disappeared into the woods, and he returned with a bushel of popped popcorn, which the Pilgrims had never tasted before. So that was some of the story and the menu of the first Thanksgiving. We're trying to bring a variety of styles to this Thanksgiving service. The prayer is on the light side. It's a prayer that was written by retired Unitarian minister Max Coutts, I think over 20 years ago, and has been used in Unitarian churches all over the country. Max served almost his whole career in Canton, New York, and he was obviously a gardener.
Let us give thanks for a bounty of people, for children who are our second planting. And though they grow like weeds and the wind too soon blows them away, may they forgive us our cultivation and fondly remember where their roots are. For generous friends with hearts and smiles as bright as blossoms, for feisty friends as tart as apples.
Let us give thanks for continuous friends who, like scallions and cucumbers, keep reminding us that we've had them. For crotchety friends, as sour as rhubarb and as indestructible. For handsome friends who are as gorgeous as eggplants and as elegant as a row of corn. And the others, as plain as potatoes and as good for you.
Let us give thanks for funny friends who are as silly as Brussels sprouts and as amusing as Jerusalem artichokes, and serious friends, as complex as cauliflowers and as intricate as onions. For friends as unpretentious as cabbages, as subtle as summer squash, as persistent as parsley, as delightful as dill, and as endless as zucchini, and who, like parsnips, can be counted on to see you throughout the winter.
Let us give thanks for old friends nodding like sunflowers in the eventime, and young friends coming on as fast as radishes. For loving friends who wind around us like tendrils and hold us despite our blights, wilts, and witherings. And finally, for those friends now gone, like gardens past that have been harvested, and who fed us in their times that we might have life thereafter.
For all these we give thanks. Amen. This is the first time that Davidson and I have shared the pulpit. And it occurred to me in the 9:30 service that not only did he conveniently lose his voice, he took all the good lines and then had to have the last word. Interesting. My memories of Thanksgiving as a child are of my grandparents' house and huge family gatherings with cousins and aunts and uncles. And to this day, I still have to resist the urge to put black olives on all of my fingers. Did you do that too? My grandmother was an elegant lady and a wonderful cook, and we had tons of food and lots of fabulous desserts. But my favorite memory of all is of my grandfather, a silver-haired gentleman with a magnificent mustache named Wilbur Riley McCullough. He sat at the head of the beautiful table covered with lace, set with crystal goblets, fine china, and silver. And just for the cheap thrill of hearing his six grandchildren laugh hysterically, he would remove his teeth in the middle of dinner. And my grandmother would look over her glasses and raise her eyebrows at him and say, "Wilbur." This repeated every year without fail. But I was an adult before I was aware that not everybody has wonderful memories of Thanksgiving. Big, happy family gatherings and abundance are not the norm for so many folks, and these were things that I just took for granted. We had gifts of privilege that not many people have, not all people around the world. So being truly thankful for our gifts is a good beginning, but hopefully the natural effect of gratitude would be a desire to share, to give back what has been given. When I was a single mother, barely surviving, I was given a gift that I wanted to repay because I was so amazed that someone would just give me $100 for no other reason than kindness. The woman told me of a child whose family was so poor that they could not afford to buy her eyeglasses. A caring teacher took her to the eye doctor and paid for her glasses. She told the little girl that someday she could repay the good deed by helping someone else. Of course, that woman in the story was the little girl. The woman was the little girl in the story. And she not only helped me, she helped everyone she could. I've never forgotten her kindness. And I've never forgotten my promise to pass the blessing. That's why the words of our song were so important. The suggestion that we rededicate Thanksgiving Day to helping the hungry, the poor, and the homeless, so that all might be able to say thanks. Thanks for the hearth and the bounty. There are so many ways that we can be thankful. The events of this past week, National Hunger and Homeless Awareness Week, have been dedicated to promoting awareness that we have a serious homeless problem in this country. Terrible deprivation exists due to poverty. There are too many people without enough money to have even the basic necessities of life. Austin is actually doing a really good job of feeding the homeless. I spent 5 hours yesterday on a street retreat in the streets of Austin with the homeless, and I ate lunch at Angel House. The food was hot, delicious, and abundant. But the reality is that there aren't enough shelters, and shelters don't really qualify as hearth. In the streets yesterday, I found the same generosity of spirit that I had found in San Francisco last March when I was on a 4-day retreat in the Tenderloin with the Faithful Fools. Homeless people shared food with me, wisdom, kind words, and when I admired one man's patchwork quilt and asked him where I might find a blanket, he told me to go to the Salvation Army, and then he called to me as I was walking away. And he said, "Hey, if you can't find a blanket, come back here to me. I have an extra one stashed, and I'll give it to you." His generosity stunned me. One participant in the street retreat shared her experience of generosity, said that it reminded her of the story of the widow's mite in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus watched the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury and noticed a widow cast in her 2 mites unto the offerings of God. He declared that she had cast in more than they all had because she had given all that she had. And this was a common experience that we all had yesterday. Susan, my faithful fool friend from San Francisco, has said that the street retreats for her have become a spiritual practice of presence and bearing witness. The purpose of street retreats is to create a shift in perception. A radical shift occurs when the people living on the streets can be recognized as human beings, as our brothers and sisters. When the myths are abolished that all homeless choose their situation by either laziness or addiction. The global problem of economic oppression is systemic. And it's so deeply embedded in our way of life that it's virtually unrecognizable. There is a blindness that accompanies privilege. The most troubling thing that I found yesterday on the streets was that there seemed to be a prevalent belief that they, the homeless, had fallen from the grace of God and that somehow they were being punished. God had nothing to do with this problem. In my opinion, the problem is with our economic system, and unfortunately, those who can do something about it are usually the last ones to know. Remember the Titanic. The passengers in the steerage compartments knew there was a problem. They were the ones who died first. Those in the bottom of the boat are the first to know when it's sinking. There were no lifeboats where they were, no chance for survival. And they were like the canaries in the coal mines, only nobody was paying attention. Did you know that there are more shelters in this country for animals than there are for people? There were 2 members of this church that joined me on the street retreat yesterday. 12 of us total. People from Arch and Caritas and I worked for 3 months to promote and prepare for the week's events. Three members of the Faithful Fools Ministry from San Francisco flew in to perform, to advise, and to lead us on this journey. The street retreat is a unique way to cross social barriers and dismantle the myths, to abolish prejudice, but more importantly, a way to enter wholeheartedly into the family of humanity. There's a table set up in the gallery with lots of information about the Faithful Fools Ministry. I hope that you will pick it up and read them. Last Monday, we hosted a Faces of the Homeless panel here in this church, and one of the participants had just gotten her own apartment a couple of months ago. She'd slept outside most of last winter, and she shared how much it meant to her to be able to go to the store and buy Halloween candy and have children knocking at her door and trick-or-treat. It made me ashamed that I had reluctantly bought candy with the intention that I would buy my favorite kind and sort of hope that nobody came to my door. I was dreading being interrupted by knocks on the door for candy by kids, and I didn't even appreciate what a privilege it is to have a home and a door to be knocked on. My own privilege blinds me to what I'm doing sometimes. Maybe yours does too. Gratitude. Meister Eckhart once said that if the only prayer we say was thanks, that it would be enough. Just thanks. So may we all be filled with thanks this Thanksgiving, and may we be filled with simple gratitude for the many, many blessings we seldom take time to notice. And may we be filled to overflowing so that those who have even fewer gifts than we do might be nourished by our overflow. So this Thanksgiving, pass the turkey and the pumpkin pie, and remember to pass the blessing. Amen.
Kathy spoke from a very real, very down-to-earth place that came from her passion for trying to see ourselves in the faces of others and trying to bridge the differences and find our common humanity. I decided to come at Thanksgiving from a very different direction since we have two of us to do it this morning. We can talk about Thanksgiving as a kind of generic holiday where we have a chance just to accept life as a sacred gift and be thankful for all we have. But I think the truth is that we don't really do that very well. I don't do it very well. Mostly, we think we have to earn our rewards, and that if gifts are just sort of scattered around, they can't be worth much. So I think it's easy to talk glibly about Thanksgiving, but I think it's a lot harder, really, to feel thankful just for the unearned gift of being here. Now, there's an ancient story about this, as there is about everything, and I want to share it with you, even though it's a story you have probably never in your lives thought of as a Thanksgiving story. It's the parable of the prodigal son from the Christian scriptures. Maybe you don't know it. I'll tell it to you. A man had two sons who'd worked on the farm, and the younger of the two sons decided one day he'd had enough of this farm business and he wanted the high life. And so he demanded from his father his half of the inheritance in advance. Now, you could do that under Jewish law of the first century. And if you did that, the father had to be able to sell or come up with the money for half of the whole inheritance in this case, because he had two sons. But if you did that, you were severing all ties with your family, and you could never again make any demands of any kind on your family. It's a very severe thing to do. So the young prodigal son did this, and he took the money and he ran, and he squandered it on loose living, wine, woman, and song, wound up completely destitute, working in another city for a pig farmer, feeding the pigs and living with the pigs. And it occurred to him one day that even the servants on his father's farm had it better than he did now. And he decided to return to his father, certainly not to be asked to be taken in, because he had no right to do that. Simply to ask that he be employed as a servant, where he could live better and eat better than he is now. So he returned home and told his father all this. And his father welcomed him with open arms, and then he dressed him up in a fancy robe and a ring, the way you would treat royalty if they came. And he gave instructions that the fatted calf be slaughtered and that there be a great feast. And that's the prodigal son story. You may wonder how on earth this has anything to do with Thanksgiving. I think that's because we mostly think of ourselves and think of the story through the eyes of the prodigal son. And we're glad to think that we might be forgiven if we mess up as royally as he did. But how do you think the older brother felt? The story doesn't talk about that. I've always thought most of us would identify with the older brother more than with the prodigal son. The original story leaves the older brother's reaction out, which I think is a terrible injustice. Luckily, I happened to find a soliloquy by the older brother in a really ancient computer file. So I want to be the older brother for a few minutes, long enough to tell you his story and see if we don't see something of ourselves in it around Thanksgiving time. All right, now look. I've worked on this farm my whole life. I've always been a faithful son and a hard worker. I've always carried my share of the load and done my job. Since my brother left, it's been harder with only my father and I to do all the work, but we've done it. We've each worked harder and longer in order to carry the weight that my brother dropped on our shoulders. But that's what life's like sometimes. You do it. You pick up your share of the load and you do your job. That's what it means to be part of the human community. So we've done it. I'm not saying this is painful drudgery. It's not. In the bigger picture of things, there's a kind of balance to life. There's a kind of justice to it that makes it all right. Each year, we fatten a calf at the beginning of the season, and we fatten it throughout the planting and the harvesting season, so that at the harvest, we can kill the fatted calf, and there can be a harvest festival as a reward for those who have earned it. That's what makes the whole picture balanced and fair. Now, how would you feel if you'd returned home today, as I did, tired and hungry, to find the makings of a great feast? What's going on? I asked. And one of the servants told me that my wastrel of a brother had finally returned home, his money squandered and his honor gone, and that my father had been so overjoyed by this shameful return that he'd killed the fatted calf. That was our fatted calf. That was my fatted calf. I earned it. That's the calf that was killed. There'll be no fatted calf for the harvest festival this year. There will be no feast for those who have earned it, because it's being spent and squandered instead on the one who did nothing, who earned nothing, and who made life harder for those of us who did our jobs. And to see that calf slaughtered for this feast, to honor that brother who did those things, it's not right. Don't tell me you wouldn't be outraged if this happened to you. You would be. And I was outraged, and I had a fit. Come in, the servant had the gall to say to me. Your father told me to welcome you in. I will not, I said. I will not come in. I will not come in through that door for that feast. It is unclean and unholy, and it's wrong. If I can't stop the sacrilege, at least I don't have to endorse it. My father can do this to me, but he can't get my complicity. I can at least keep my integrity. I will not come in to this stupid feast. I threw a fit. Well, there are more details and more complaints, but that's the gist of it. That's the gist of my story. Those are the things I've been repeating to myself as I sit out here on this hill looking across at my house where my brother parades around in a robe and a ring dressed like a king, and my father sanctions the whole mess in the name of a cheap and misguided love. And I know that of all the people who hear this story, most will take my side in it. Rewards have to be earned. You can't give thanks for an unfair life. If I know anything, I know that. But now the finale, for here comes my father. He's seen me sitting here on the hill in my grand pout, and he's come to fetch me. Well, there'll be no surprises. We know each other well, and I know well what he will say. Come, he will say, to the feast. I will not, I will answer. It's an unfair feast. It's a feast of forgiveness and thanksgiving, he will say, not of justice. I don't care if it's a feast of forgiveness and thanksgiving. It's an unfair feast of forgiveness and thanksgiving, and I won't have any part in it. This will go on back and forth a few more times. And then after a few more exchanges like that, my father will look at me, and that look of his I've known my whole life. And he'll hold my face, and he'll kiss me on the cheek. He'll look me in the eyes, and he'll say, the door is open, my son. And it can be no more than open. It's open for you, and it's open for your brother, as it has always been. Your brother was lost, and he has found himself. So there is a feast of thanksgiving going on, a feast for the gift and the return of life, and you're invited to it. If you refuse, it will be only your own pettiness and anger that keep you out, and only your own bitterness that you shall taste. So, come into the feast, or sit alone on your hillside and pout. But the door is open. You are invited, and you are loved. He'll turn after that and go back to the house. And then I shall have to decide.
Other trees, we gather fruit from trees we did not plant. We drink from wells we did not dig. Let us give so that others may receive. Your offerings for the ongoing work of this church will now be accepted.